You are listening to Powder Radio. Brought to you by Powder Magazine.
Welcome to Sponsored. I'm your host, Mike Powell, and this is the first show on Powder Radio. We are excited to take you through 34 interviews with professional skiers, where we will find out what it took to become sponsored, how they made their way in the ski industry, and we will try to find out about the drama, the bumps in the road, and the positive experiences that come along with being a professional skier. I know what it takes to become a professional skier, as I spent 15 years managing athletes in the ski industry. I know it's not all about God-given ability. There's a lot of marketing and self-promotion that goes along with it as well, and we will talk to our guests about all of that. And from you, our listeners, we are looking for show feedback and potential questions for our future guests. You can find our guest list on the show notes on Powder's website, and you can reach me at PowellMovement1 on Twitter, or you can shoot me an email at mike@thepowellmovement.com. Now it's time for our first guest. He is the 1% of what skiers are today. He's got his own reality television show, Keep Your Tips Up. He's featured in this month's Powder Magazine. He also owns a restaurant, Legs Diamond, in Whistler Blackcomb. He's a skier, an entertainer, an entrepreneur. He is Sean Pettit. And Sean Pettit's lived a charmed life in the ski world. Sponsors came to Sean. He had some professional skiers who kind of spread the word of a little kid who was coming up who was going to be the next great thing in skiing. No one realized he was going to be the best skier on the planet. Sean sits on the top of the ski world, and I'm excited to bring him on the program. Here is Sean Pettit. Pettit.
Mad Mike.
How you doing, man?
I'm doing good, man. How you doing?
I am doing well. How is the man of leisure?
He's doing quite fine, actually. Just a little sunny day in Old Whistler here.
Nice. Well, I've been following you on your Instagram and your Snapchat, and your life seems like it is just perfect. I mean, you boat, you drink cocktails, you have ladies around you. What's the life of Sean Pettit this summer?
It's been pretty much, I mean, you kind of summed it up pretty good there. My Instagram pretty much displays a good perception of my lifestyle. Yeah, a lot of boating on my boat, which I named Little Richard. And yeah, just having good times, you know, soaking up the sunshine before I travel to only cold places for the next 6 months.
Right, right. Yeah, that's been your winter for probably the past 20 years. You're what, 24 now?
I'm 24 now, yep.
Wow, and I think you and I met up when you were probably 11, I think.
I think you're pretty much right on the button there, 11 years old.
Yeah, I think you had just moved from Quebec and you were at Whistler and, you know, your career kind of took off, I think, once you moved to Whistler. How did that progress so fast?
You know, it's funny because I was kind of laying it out on a timeline the other day just for some website stuff, personal use. And I realized myself how fast it happened when I realized when I put it into this timeline. When I was younger, it seemed like it happened over a long period of time. But in all reality, I mean, we moved here and then within a year or two, we were, you know, being noticed on Whistler Blackcomb and almost immediately got sponsored by Oakley and K2 and got logo slapped on us right away. And I don't think I realized how quickly that happened until I actually looked back, not just recently and saw that.
Yeah, your life's been crazy. You've been a branded kid since you were 10, 11 years old. And I know you moved to Whistler in 99 and then immediately, I'm sure, started following the pros at Whistler Mountain. And that's kind of how you got recognized.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that was the deal. I think, you know, park skiing was really hot then because it was something so new and, you know, no one had ever seen skiers go in the park, stuff like that. And I didn't realize that I was at the very beginning stages of that in the new skiing world. I was just following these dudes around that were good. And sure enough, you know, their wake made us noticeable.
So who were the people that you were following around when you first got to Whistler? I know it was you and your brother Callum, and you probably followed whoever you could find.
Well, at the time, it was myself, Callum, and Kai Peterson. You know, as soon as me and Callum, my brother, had moved to Whistler, we pretty much, you know, became really good friends with Kai. And then pretty much our crew, we'd follow around Chris Turpin. He was kind of the little Grom ringleader. And we just, you know, bug him all day, every day and follow him around and get us to get him to, you know, do stuff for us, and we try to copy him.
Yeah, and back then it was a different Sean Pettit, I would think. When you got on the mountain, it was you wanted to be skiing from bell to bell every single day of the week, didn't matter the conditions. I would think that probably changes as you get older and you start going on heli trips and have budgets and experience a different world of skiing.
Of course. I mean, for sure back then it was, I was in school, you know, 5 days a week. And I couldn't wait till Saturday and Sunday just to go ski on the weekend during the winter time. And then, you know, holidays, stuff like that. I just couldn't wait, make sure that we were there. Yeah. From when the mountain opened to when the mountain closed. Now it's a bit of a different story. I mean, now, you know, you get spoiled. I got spoiled with helicopters and these trips around the world to only where the snow is falling and, you know, the best snow conditions at the time, you know, we're pretty much there at all times. So yeah, I get a little spoiled, and sometimes now I just really pick and choose my days and try to still keep it exciting.
Well, you and Cal were really lucky. Your mom, Deb, is an amazing woman, and she used to pull you out of school on powder days from what I remember. And I'd talk to her, I'd be like, oh, Sean at school? And she'd be like, no, I let Shawnee stay home today. We got a foot of snow. And you'd be able to ski. I mean, you say you're in school 5 days a week, but I would think it was four if you kind of averaged it out.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think we were supposed to be in school 5 days a week, but yeah, in the wintertime, I was, you know, we'd have these rules set that if it snowed enough and you wake up and you're so excited because it snowed overnight, you're not going to go to school. And that was kind of our household rules. And I think my mom knew exactly what was going on. I think she knew exactly what was happening when she realized how much me and my brother liked to ski.
She picked up her whole life and moved it to British Columbia so you guys would have a big playground. Most parents don't do that for their kids. So, you know, you're a lucky, lucky kid who turned into a lucky professional. And I won't say lucky because you worked for what you got. But your mom had a big part in making that happen for you.
Oh, 100%. 100%. She sacrificed a lot. She, you know, had this whole life out east in the Ottawa area. And that's where our whole family was. And she knew nobody in BC, but she just made the executive decision that we are going to leave this place out east and we are going to move to British Columbia because I know that there is just room for better life outside the city and in BC, Whistler particularly, where she had been to before me and my brother. She knew me and my brother out here, but just realized that she was willing to make those sacrifices to have us, I think, grow up in such a better place in here in Whistler, and she was right for sure. She made some big sacrifices once we got here, though. I mean, you know, she had to, you know, start fresh. We lived in basement suites for years. She'd be working two jobs during the day. She'd be teaching skiing, and at night she'd be at a restaurant job. She'd bring home leftovers from the restaurant she'd be working at. Sometimes that was dinner, but at the time that wasn't really. We weren't really thinking about that. We were just thinking about going skiing. I think that was really all that was on our minds. And being surrounded by the Whistler area was, you know, enough to keep us occupied.
I guess that struggle in your life really hasn't been covered by many people. I mean, you don't think of Sean Pettit as having any struggles, because when I think of your career, I won't say everything came easy to you, but people came to you because you were so talented and because you were so level-headed. And I don't think that there was any struggle in Sean's life. And then you think about that. You grew up, and I don't want to say grew up poor, but your mom needed to work two jobs to be able to allow you and Cal to play on the mountain all day long. And that's an amazing sacrifice. And really probably the most important decision to Sean Pettit's pro ski career is Deb Hillary moving from, you know, the East Coast to the West Coast and getting you guys on a big mountain.
I think that was probably the biggest thing. Yeah, I think that is my ski career for sure. I mean, I think it's whatever you surround yourself with, and, you know, being surrounded by, you know, these Whistler mountains is, you know, you're going to shape, you know, at a young age, you're going to turn into, you're going to absorb what's around you and be able to use that. Whereas if, you know, I think if we, I always think of what if we stayed back east, you know, I would be, I don't know, maybe I'd be good at something else, but I don't think it'd be skiing because I really don't think that, it's just not your surroundings out there. And so I'm pretty, very thankful actually for her, you know, surrounding us with these particular mountains and this lifestyle.
So you get to Whistler, you're there for 2 years, you're following Chris Turpin around the mountain, and I know he's pitching you to sponsors saying, hey, I've got this little kid who's going to blow your mind. At what point do you get your first sponsor? I think it was Oakley at 11, so I just kind of spoiled that.
Yeah, it was actually funny how that all unfolded. You know, just like any other day, me and my brother are, you know, chasing each other around the park and around the mountain. And, you know, that's, we're not, back then there was no like, oh, let's go filming with your buddies. Like, we didn't have, nobody had cell phones or anything. This is like early 2000s.
Okay.
And so we just, there was no thinking of trying to, you know, post something on the internet or anything like that. We just didn't have that. So it was just, you know, every day was cruising around. And one day we just, me and my brother cruise around the park all day and get down to the bottom. And then there's these two other kids that are older, you know, they're in like, they're like late teens. And, you know, me and my brother are, you know, I'm 11, he's 13. These two kids come up to us and they're huffing and puffing. And they had been like trying to hunt us down, like for, they said like a couple of runs or something. They had been chasing us around and chased us down the mountain. Finally, when we got to the bottom and stopped, they said that, oh, like, you guys are good. Like, who are you? And like, you know, we're just little kids, like, I'm Sean. Like, I can't really remember exactly how that went down, but pretty much they said, like, what's like your contact or something? I think my brother gave them like our home phone number or something, maybe, or my mom's email.
Right.
Something like that. But anyways, they ended up being relatives of a girl who worked for Oakley at the time. And so just through that little connection, that's how that all started. And then this girl hit us up from Oakley or probably hit up my mom, I'm assuming. And then she, like, really shortly later, I mean, I remember going to a little Oakley night in Whistler and meeting some people. And pretty much that was it. then I got slapped on a couple logos and some goggles and some outerwear. And then very shortly after, there was a contract. And I didn't even know what a contract was. I didn't even know what a professional skier was. I was just kind of going along with it and took it for what it was.
Yeah, you were probably very easy to take advantage of back then.
Oh, yeah, 100%. You could do anything. Free pair of goggles and a free jacket or something. I would have been more than happy. And there was lots more than that at the time coming through.
Yeah, you get a box sent to you and you're like, yeah, you've got a month of days. You can take whatever you want from me.
Yeah, and I was like, you know, mind blown. I was like, what, new Oakley stuff? I was losing it. I remember before that it was all hand-me-downs and whatever, you know, we could gather up from garage sales and stuff like that. That was our outerwear before.
Yeah, and then, you know, right after Oakley, it seemed like, I think you were 12 when K2 picked you up. And I know Turpin was involved in that one. I talked to Mike Gute about it, and he said that Turpin kind of had a, you know, conversation about Sean Pettit. And you went up to Whistler, or he went up to Whistler and skied with you and immediately put you on the program. And how did K2 evolve in your eyes?
Yeah, that happened, again, really quickly, too. It was during the Ski and Snowboard Festival, the Telus World Ski and Snowboard Festival, big event in Whistler, especially back then. That's where, you know, everyone kind of shined and made their statements of skiing and snowboarding.
Yeah, that was huge.
And I remember, I think I wasn't old enough to enter the competition. And I'm pretty sure it was Chris Turpin who was like pushing me to poach the course.
Okay.
And, so I poached the half pipe. I did a run to the half pipe. I loved riding the half pipe at that time. And then pretty much after that, K2 signed me and I realized, yeah, that happened quickly. Then I know that happened all through Chris Turpin, just through his word. And then, yeah, Mike Goot from K2 at that time pretty much said, we are sold and let's get this guy in the program. So, from there, I actually had a, it's funny because, the year before I got on K2, I did one of the local competitions. They were called the Sprite Series.
Okay.
On Blackcomb in the park. And I had done, I had won the competition. I came first and I won a pair of Atomic skis. And these Atomic skis were like twice my size. You know, they assumed that someone maybe a little taller was going to win.
Right.
And so My dad was visiting at the time, and I told him, I said, I'll give you these skis if you buy me a new pair of skis. And we went into the ski shop, and I bought a pair of K2s. I gave him some skis, and he bought me some K2s.
Nice.
And they were the mini enemies at the time. And then I got on K2, and then I remember the first pair of skis I got was the mini enemies, which was like the following year's mini enemies or something with like the Public Enemy graphic on it.
Yep.
And then that was the beginning right there.
And from the beginning, when you're on K2, it seemed like, you know, eventually I came on and started managing the team. And whenever I would travel with you, you were always the draw. It was you and Callum, but everybody wanted to see Sean Pettit ski. It didn't matter what skier it was. They all wanted to come out and see what your run was. And back then you were a competition skier. And your problem was you weren't heavy enough. I mean, we'd always joke about putting weights in your pocket because, you know, you get one good hit in the half pipe. And then after that, you know, you couldn't really get any speed. What were the challenges for you being so much smaller than everybody else?
Challenges being smaller. And I mean, essentially just that much lighter. I could bend like rubber and I could fall and get right back up. No problem. But to get speed in a half pipe, you need to carry momentum, and carrying momentum and stuff like that was not really a thing for me. I remember most competitions that we went to, either you or someone at the start gate would be slingshotting me in from my poles or pushing me from behind just to get an extra boost.
Yep.
For one in the half pipe, to get like a good first hit. But even like in the slope style when we were doing that, I mean, I always started higher. I always started higher than everyone else. Everyone else would be sessioning a jump, even just on a regular day. I'd always start like at least 20 feet higher. I figured it out. I knew that I was smaller and I knew I had to start higher.
Yeah, but you'd go just as big, especially on that first hit. And I think that's why everybody's jaw always dropped. And then the style that you brought to the table was mind-blowing. And at that point in your career, I think I told you a few different times, you know, we're going to support you regardless of what you want to do. If you want to just ski powder, that's okay. But at the time, you were a competitive skier. Not that you really were going for the win every time. You were going kind of just, I think, to not show off, but just to have fun. And that's kind of how you live your life. But at that point in your life, you're going and spending a couple weeks in the beginning of each season with Tanner Hall to train and get better at pipe and slope. And what was that like training with Tanner in the early season?
Yeah, I mean, I think when I look back on it now, we ended up when I first got hooked up with Tanner, which was when I was 13, early season, we wouldn't go train in the half pipe or go ride the park. We'd go ride powder. And that's kind of how everything kind of transitioned into that whole deal. And we would ride the park too a little bit, but I never had like a training mentality on my mind. I'm like, I never once thought that the U.S. Open is coming up. I should train. I didn't even know what training was. I didn't know what that meant. It wasn't in my vocabulary. It wasn't a thing that I had ever done before. So I wasn't going to start then. You know, I don't know what I thought about the whole competition thing. I think that's maybe why I stopped competing by the time I was, you know, 15, 16. Which is kind of sounds crazy to stop when you're that age, but it's kind of what happened. I stopped, I think, when I was around 16 because I was so much more in love with just riding for exactly what you wanted to do and not to try to one up, you know, the guy who's the best in the half pipe or in the slopestyle, just more or less doing exactly what you wanted to do. And I, luckily I was pushing myself. So I would, you know, always push myself to get better at anything that we were doing, but and go bigger. And I think you're right when you say it's part of showing off. I think at that time, yeah, I was just showing off, you know. I think, you know, trying to go big and just, you know, I think I was all about the crowd pleasers and stuff like that. So I think that was an easy transition for me to go from competing to just filming in the backcountry.
You guys had spun it to me as, hey, I'm going to go train and get ready for the comp season. And that's quite all right, too, because it really didn't matter with you. Your ability was just there and everybody knew it was going to develop more and more. So it was kind of, hey, go ski with Tanner because he works harder than anybody else out there, especially at that point in his life. And what were those sessions like with him, whether it was training or just skiing POW? How fun was that to be with one of your idols?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because when I first got introduced to Tanner, I didn't really know what to think I didn't even know Tanner Hall at the time, because it was when he was kind of just blowing up, but I didn't know that yet. And it wasn't as accessible as it is now, where there's just the internet for you to immediately know when someone's blowing up and you can just check. So at the time, I just was like, cool. Like, that sounds fun. I'm down, you know? And we just went out and did the same thing we did. We just skied, and Eric Eiberg was running a camera, and then sure enough, we were just, then Dubski 106 came out, which is the first movie I was in. And that was that. It just was like, I was just in it. And then I was like, whoa. I think I realized when I went to the premiere of that movie in the fall, in Park City, and there's like this red carpet and there's all these people there. There's this massive screen, a movie playing on it. I had a little bit of a realization of the rock star lifestyle I was about to enter.
So you were, what, 15 when that happens?
No, that was, I was 13, yeah.
Wow, so that's got to be pretty mind-blowing. What do you think when you see Tanner now and his internet persona and all the different things that go along with Tanner Hall?
Yeah, I mean, he has had a roller coaster of a life, and he's gone through some shit, and he definitely has had an insane career so far and still running, which is impressive.
So at 13, you also signed with Red Bull. And before I talk about signing with Red Bull, I brought it up, but I want to talk about agents, because that's something that not every pro skier has. And want to see, what made you decide to pick up an agent, and how your agent, I believe it's Jameson Keegan, who's an amazing guy and a great agent as well, what he does for Sean Pettit and how he makes your life easier.
Totally. I was 14 when I got picked up by Red Bull, and it was Jameson Keegan, who was working for Red Bull Canada at the time, who actually signed me to Red Bull at 14. And so he was my team manager at Red Bull 14, 15, 16, I think up until I was maybe 17.
Okay.
No, he was my team manager for a first year, and then he moved up in the company in Red Bull, and he had got Gabe Atier as the team manager, who worked right alongside Jameson. So those two kind of were my team managers at Red Bull for my first couple of years at Red Bull. And they kind of acted more than team managers, both of them. Red Bull was very new to Canada at the time too. And, you know, they were super supportive, and you know, they went out and found opportunities for me. I didn't really have to go to them with anything other than yes or no, if I wanted to do something or go somewhere, because they started to set up all these things, and they were almost acting like my agents. And then when Jameson decided to leave Red Bull, before he left, he had asked me, hey, if I leave Red Bull and start this agency, would you want to be on my program? And I almost didn't really have to think twice about it. I was just like, you know, I haven't even thought about getting an agent because I was, you know, 16, but if it's going to be anybody, I was like, for sure, it's going to be you, because you've kind of acted like that, my agent already. And I don't want that to stop, because you're killing it for me right now. So, it was an easy yes. And I was the first one to sign with Jameson's new agency at the time, which was Superheroes Management. And I'm still with him. That's almost 8-9 years ago.
Okay, so you have an agent, and I understand Jameson's someone you trust. That's really important in the agent process, or the agent selection process. But in terms of just dollars and cents, when you have an agent, I'm sure he handles all the conversations with your sponsors. You don't have to deal with the negotiations. He also gets a cut. I would think it's around 20%. I think that's like a standard, but not 100% sure, and you don't have to tell me any numbers. But how does your agent earn his money?
Yeah, I mean, he goes to battle for me. The part that I don't want to do, you know, I want to stick to the skiing part and fun parts. I didn't enter this in the first place as a businessman, and I don't think that's where I shine as much. Although I have learned a lot over the past many years being involved with it, but he's just, that's his expertise. And how he earns dollars is, yeah, he finds deals with brands in sport, out of sport, you know, things that sometimes we would never think of, but being in an agency, you know, you get all these contacts and people from all over looking for athletes. And yeah, he takes percentage of when brands want to brand my brand.
But in terms of Jameson, when he's negotiating deals, when you want to put a movie project together, do you go to Jameson and say, hey, Jameson, this is what I want to do. I want you to pitch this to Red Bull and get me the budget for it. Or do you talk to Red Bull about that?
Now it's become much of a conjoined thing. But for sure, the first person I go to is Jameson when we have any project in mind, film related, photo related, anything really. And he's done a really good job at, you know, he will put, you know, my blabber of what I'm telling him over the phone or on an email, he'll put it into, you know, like a very professional document, something that's got a good presentation.
Little pitch deck.
Yeah, little pitch decks and you know, photos, video inspiration, stuff like that. He'll put this all into, you know, these slides and these decks and have them very presentable. You know, it's what he does best is he's makes it easy for people to say yes.
Well, he's done a great job of it. You know, every year you've got some new projects, you know, between movies, a reality show. Everybody really loves to promote Sean Pettit because I think you have just the personality. You've always been humble. And to me, when I met you at, you know, 13 or however old you were, I was blown away with how you seemed, you know, wise beyond your years. I remember we were at an Indian restaurant once. I hate Indian food and really didn't want to be there. And I looked next to me and there's this little punk kid sitting there. That's you. And you're like, hey, man, just order the chicken satay and you'll be fine. I don't listen to you. I order something else. I'm very unhappy with my meal. And I look and you're just laughing at me like, dude, I don't like Indian food either. This is what you have to order to be happy at an Indian restaurant. And that's when I realized that you knew what was up way more than your traditional 13-year-old. And you continued to do that throughout your entire career. But you've had a lot of fun times too. And I want you to, you know, tell us some fun stories from the road, some things that you never thought you'd see.
Mike, I would not know where to start. Yeah. I think to sum that up, I was wise beyond my years. And I think I had to because I was put into a lifestyle that wasn't necessarily fit for every average 13-year-old.
Right.
Which was great. I think that shaped me into a mature adult quickly. It made me skip my childhood for sure and right into it. But at the time, I had no problem with that. You know, when you're younger, you always want to be older. You want to hang with the older kids. Well, I definitely was, and I was doing everything that every one of the older kids was doing, for sure. You know, there was you're introduced to partying and that lifestyle for sure at a young age. Yeah, I think, you know, every professional athlete knows what it's like. But if you don't, it's high pace lifestyle, traveling around, moving to different places, staying in, you know, some amazing places, having everything at your fingertips, hotels, parties, girls. I mean, it was kind of all there and handed in a silver platter at the time. And it was awesome. Don't regret anything I've done in the past.
It's funny that you say parties and girls, because when I remember traveling with you, I think I was your legal guardian on many a trip in the U.S. I remember you not really hanging out with too many girls and not really partying at all. I think there was one event, one U.S. Open. We had Stian Beebe got like second or third, and we had some mansion we were staying in. And I bought the whole crew beer, which was illegal. But at the time, when someone wins, that was kind of the rule. But I don't remember you partying much other than that. Were you able to do that behind my back when we were traveling?
Okay, there was a certain age point where that changed over. But yeah, when I was 13, no, I think I knew better than that, than to be drinking and partying. Then I think just being there was fun and not having to drink and party then. But definitely when I hit 15, 16, I was definitely partying 100%.
Gotcha. And I didn't really see all of that as, you know, not that I was going to bed early, but I was doing my own partying and I don't think it was around you guys. So, you know, we'd rendezvous back at the place and you guys would wake up, you know, ready for first chair every day. So it never seemed like it was an issue.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. No, I don't think it really ever was. I think it was, that's all part of growing up as a professional skier.
Cool. So I want to talk about Red Bull. As you know, as a company, they do some really phenomenal things for their athletes. And I know you're sponsored by Oakley, you're sponsored by K2. And yeah, those are two great sponsors. But you know, from the K2 end, I know what K2 does with you. They'll have you on a couple photo shoots each year. They might take you on a dealer trip. And other than that, you're kind of left alone to be Sean Pettit and live your life. But with Red Bull, they create a lot of events and things around the athletes to make you better, whether it's media training or, you know, celebrity events. What are some of the things that Red Bull does that separates themselves from your other sponsors?
Yeah, I mean, they come from a, you know, very mainstream world, and they are involved in so many events and things around not just one sport, which is what every other brand I'm with is ski specific. I guess we can think about it, you know, the ski world compared to every other bit of the world is very small. And so, yeah, Red Bull does a great job of you know, getting, they want to pick up an athlete that is a blank canvas. They don't want to pick up an athlete that's already a finished product. They want to, and who is successful, but they want to pretty much have a project. So when I got picked up by Red Bull, they saw potential,
right?
Not knowing if it's going to work or not, but they create all these opportunities to make sure that we go on the right path to be a successful star athlete. And that's what they did. I mean, when I first got on, they immediately started, you know, they hit up film companies. You know, I started filming with Matchstick Productions shortly after I got on Red Bull, the second year I think I was on. So with Matchstick, which at the time was like massive.
Yeah.
Biggest ski film company there was. You know, they're, you know, paying for photographers who are the best photographers shooting for, you know, the biggest magazines. They're, you know, creating events that showcase what we do best. And, you know, putting, you know, me and the other Red Bull stars on, you know, the poster boys for and stuff. So yeah, that's just like a few things that I can think of. They did so much for us as athletes to grow us into their star athletes, and it's because of them that I'm kind of here now. Is without those opportunities, it's hard to create that. I mean, you think about, I guess I think in skiing it's kind of the same thing, but in Hollywood, say it's all about who you know. If you don't know somebody, you're gonna have a hard time getting anywhere. And well, with them, I mean, everybody knew who they were, and they made sure that everyone knew who we were.
Yeah, they do a great job at that. And I'm going to jump around to some other sponsors because I have some sponsorship questions that maybe I should have hit earlier, but you know what? It's a podcast. We can hit them whenever we want. And one is, when you were with K2, and you still are with K2, but there was a time when you and Callum Pettit, your brother, were on K2. And you know, at the offices at K2, we had to make some difficult decisions. And one of those decisions was, hey, we can only have one Pettit on the program. And Sean Pettit's the one that we want on the program. He's the one getting more exposure. He's the one we see with bigger potential. You know, kind of the directive was, all right, Mike Powell, you're going to have to go up to Whistler, sit down with all the Pettits, and drop Callum Pettit. And we went, and I think we had a burger. It was me, your mom, Callum. And we're sitting down and we had that conversation and I had to let Callum go, which was one of the toughest things I ever had to do in my career. When you're sitting with a brother and you're saying, hey, I'm going to separate you and your brother on this program, and Callum, this is going to be the best thing for you, even though you don't see this yet. What was your thoughts in that conversation when that was happening?
Yeah, I don't know if I remember specifically the conversation, but I remember the time when it happened, because, you know, when I got picked up by Oakley, both me and my brother got picked up by Oakley. When I got picked up by K2. It was both me and my brother that got picked up as K2. And, you know, when we were in Tanner's first two movies, we were the Pettit brothers for the first two films. It wasn't Sean Pettit and Callum Pettit. It was the Pettit brothers, or Sean and Callum Pettit. So we were identified as one piece. You know, we were a package deal.
Yep.
And we were both very different. And we wanted to be individuals, you know. I mean, we wanted to be like, we didn't want to be looked at as this package, you know. We weren't twins or anything. I picture it as like identical twins or something, but we're very different. We don't even look alike. No, but but we were super tight and we skied always together. So I think that's why it was easy for, you know, brands at the beginning to just get this package deal. But I think when that happened, we both kind of wanted it to happen, but not necessarily in that sense. You know, I mean, at the time I felt super bad that, you know, I was gonna, you know, stay on K2 and he was, and like, he wasn't going to stay on the program, or he wasn't going to get the opportunity that I was going to get on. And I felt like indebted to him, and I wanted to somehow, you know, make sure that he got what he needed to do, or you know, he, a new brand to get on or something. But I felt bad for sure at the beginning, but I think we both knew it was going to be good for us to have different sponsors, because then we could be looked at as individuals. And that's exactly what happened. So I think it was, you know, because of you and at K2 that made that separation, that almost shaped his career in a sense, instead of being, you know, in his little brother's shadow, he made a name for himself because he had these other brands and for them to showcase him. And that's still kind of what's happening today is, you know, we don't have any of the same sponsors, because then it would just, we'd kind of be looked at as, again, little package deal. You know, it's the brothers thing that that is easy for people to look at as too closely tied together. So it's good. Now we have our independence.
Yeah, and you're still able to work together on things like your reality show, which I caught the full season of not too long ago. How fun has that project been to work on?
Yeah, that's been super fun. I mean, for the brothers thing, for sure. I mean, you know, we hadn't filmed together in many years because, you know, after the K2 separation and shortly later, the him getting cut from Oakley and stuff. So we had, you know, all different sponsors, which means he was going to film with different film companies. When I was filming with Matchstick, he was filming with TGR. So I almost like wouldn't even see him all winter. He'd be on different trips and stuff like that. And we barely ski together. And so once this reality show got picked back up, it was really fun to, you know, pretty much spend the whole season with him again. And it was just kind of at our freedom. You know, we had, it was really up to us exactly. Whatever we wanted to do was we were going to do. And whatever we wanted the show to be about, the show was going to be about. And I for sure knew that I wanted it to be, me and my brother have a hilarious relationship, especially when there's cameras around to capture that. So I knew that that was going to be entertaining. And then for sure involving our dad, Groovemeister, as he is a new resident to Whistler, was going to be very entertaining as well. And it was, and the first season of that was a great success. And we went into the second season and with the same concept. So I got to spend, the past two seasons pretty much with my brother skiing side by side.
Well, that's awesome. I have some feedback on the show after watching it. When I think of Sean Pettit, I think everything's kind of come easy for you. And I know you've had to work for stuff, but my perception is, you know, Sean doesn't train. He just gets paid. You know, he goes and skis and everything he does is gold. And when I watch the reality show, I notice that there isn't the antagonistic character in the show. I know that the Groovemeister, a.k.a. your father, is that guy. And I think we have to do something more. I don't want to kill him, but I do think we should hurt him more. And when I say we, I'm no part of this whatsoever. But there just needs to be a little bit more drama around the Groovemeister. I mean, he was a little bit scared of hitting that kicker on the water. But I think you need to put him on a bull. I think you need to put him in situations where he will really lose his mind, and then, you know, where he has no control of his emotions and we can kind of laugh at him, because that's really, I think, going to be the drama. And I think you use the Groovemeister for drama.
Absolutely. That's I mean, solely what we, you know, I think any reality show needs to have a very high entertainment factor. You know, a skier going and skiing around the world is cool, but can it be entertaining and different everywhere we go in the world, every trip we go on? And that's why Groovemeister was solely introduced, to be that dramatic character that really stirs up the pot. He definitely stirs things up in season two. So, watch out for that. That comes out, November 5th, I believe, and plays every week on Red Bull TV. But, yes, I agree. Groovemeister is a great character. But we can push him more. I'm down with that.
Yeah, I mean, if you need any suggestions, there's some great examples that I could show you on YouTube that I found recently of pranks that will make your father not want to live in Whistler anymore. And I think that's the level you need to go.
Totally. Well, I think I kicked him out of my house with some little ways that I didn't just tell him to leave because living in my house is so great.
Right.
But I started to make it shitty for him to live in my house. And that's ultimately why it wasn't hard for him to leave.
Cool. Well, I'm excited to see that. I want to see him uncomfortable. The next thing I want to hit is Superproof.
Yeah.
What's going on with Superproof? I saw there was a post recently that made it look like Superproof might be still in existence, but I don't know what's going on with it.
Yes. I'm keeping that under wraps. I can tell you Superproof was never a production company. It was just a label for us to do what we want to do creatively and with our crew. And it was just an easy way to create a creative source. But I've always had other ideas for Superproof from the beginning. Video was ultimately an easy way to announce that there is a Superproof.
Okay.
But I can tell you now that the future of Superproof is not solely through video. But I'm not going to tell you exactly what that is. You will see over the next year.
Holograms, man. Holograms.
Yeah. Crazy shit.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been pretty exciting. I've been working on a lot of fun things, but definitely keep it under wraps for now.
All right. Well, thanks for sharing nothing on Superproof. Are you still working with the same crew? Is that Superproof crew together, like editors, filmers?
No. Superproof right now is me. That's it. And I think that's kind of how I want it to be for now. Superproof before I created some opportunity and found some talented people that I personally handpicked as who I personally think is most talented at what they do, and like Lee Powis at the time, just starting editing, but I loved the way he edited.
Yep.
And edited and directed and just had a creative sense. And so after we put out those films, now he's a full-time editor and director. He's got a career for himself now.
Wow, that's awesome. Did you take the jacket back now that you guys aren't working together? Do you let them keep those jackets?
No, those jackets are forever. Everyone's still hanging on to them as memento pieces.
Demand for something that's not existent has been part of your life for a long time with Red Bull, as you can't buy any Red Bull merchandise anywhere, it seems like, the branded athlete merchandise. But since you were 13, they've owned your head, it seems like. How does that work?
I couldn't tell you if in the contract it actually says that they own my head, but pretty much does. It's a great business marketing thing they do, and they create these hats and the helmets. And this logo is only to be worn by Red Bull athletes, which also creates you almost trick the viewer into perceiving this athlete as so superior because he has something that you can't get. So I think that has been that's just a good, well done job of marketing. And I can assure you that the hats are no different than most. They don't give you special powers or anything, but they definitely make you look pretty damn cool to everyone else who can't get them.
Yeah, they do make some cool stuff. So I'm going to ask you a couple final questions. And, this is all related to sponsorship, as this show is called Sponsored. Right now, you've got some challenges, I think, with, a couple of your sponsors. And I don't know if they're personal challenges, but I know there's been some major changes on the K2 front, and wondering when your next contract has to be signed with K2 and if you're looking to be a K2 for life person.
Yeah, in general, the industry is going through hard times, every industry will have its ups and downs. But this industry is it's fairly small, and it's hard. It's being difficult to expand and get people to essentially buy more ski product. But me personally, I don't look at that as much of a hit. Maybe some contracts will be smaller than before, but doesn't necessarily stop me from what I'm doing at all, really. Just sparks me to have new ideas. And I do consider myself a K2 for lifer. They've brought me up from day one. I certainly don't intend on leaving now because I have too big a piece of my heart there. But now is the time to re-up with K2 and where we are working on that as we speak. So I definitely think that it's going to be me staying with K2. I can pretty much assure you that.
Well, that's awesome to hear. I mean, it's tough for you to leave K2. You're pretty much branded K2, Oakley, and Red Bull straight up. I mean, if you went to another brand, it would be 10 years before they really associated you with that brand just based on your heritage and loyalty.
Exactly. And I think longevity has, you know, been a part of success for me with these brands. Now that I sit here and I'm still in the same brands, I realize that it's been beneficial and that I should probably stick to it.
Yeah. No, it's worked out for you. So where are we going to see Sean Pettit this fall? You know, I know you're going to be on the big screen and different things. Where are we going to see you?
What I'm going to be doing this year is I'm going to be doing an entirely on social media series where there's no links to any other websites or any other web pages from the social pages. It goes directly to the social media outlet.
So it's kind of social Shawnee with no links.
Yep, absolutely. Straight to my Instagram, my Facebook, and just so people can pretty much follow exactly what I'm doing all year long as it's happening.
I feel like I've been doing that all summer too, you know, just seeing you in the skate park. Oh, he's got this kickflip. Oh, look at that girl over there. She's framed up nicely. So I think it'll be a more of an extension of the man of leisure, but into the winter.
Exactly. And I think that's what my brand is all about. You know, I've promoted the fun of the sport for a while. That's how I want to portray my entire part of the sport as. So people can, I want to be able to think that people can just go out and do exactly what I do all year, which they should be able to.
All right, so you heard it here first. The future of Sean Pettit skiing is going to be looked at as video clips that are uploaded from his phone, just like a 15-year-old would do. Sean, I do want to say I want to thank you for coming onto the show. I know you've lived an amazing life, and you know you've made all the right decisions, which doesn't create, you know, the most dramatic interview, but it's interesting to hear your sponsorship process and everything that's gone along with your sponsors. And I want to thank you for the time and look forward to seeing you do more of what Sean Pettit does best, and that's live the life of leisure, sometimes in the sun, sometimes in the snow.
Yes, thank you, Mike. Good to talk to you, and super fun to relay some information.
All right. Well, thanks, Sean. And we will talk to you soon.
Cheers, Mike.
So that was my interview with Sean Pettit. He lives a charmed life up there in Whistler. And if you follow his Instagram, you can see the escapades of Sean Pettit. And you can tell his media training paid off. He threw no one under the bus. I tried countless times to get him to give us some dirt on people and in the ski industry, and he was able to avoid those questions. He gave us no information on Superproof, said nothing about Tanner's online persona, and that's Sean Pettit. You know, he's good at what he's doing for a reason, and we found that in the interview. Next week on Sponsored, we have Wayne Wong, and it's going to be another great interview with Wayne to talk about the history of skiing. But we do have additional content with Sean Pettit. If you head over to the Powell Movement, which is a new podcast that I'll be launching in November, we've got a segment called Inappropriate Questions. Some questions we didn't want to ask on the Powder channels, and Sean's going to answer them over there on thepowellmovement.com. So you can find that Sean Pettit additional content over there. I thank you for listening to Sponsored, and we will see you next Wednesday with Wayne Wong.